Wherever the road may take you, Discount Tire and Continental Tire get you there safely with the perfect combination of style, comfort, and price. Get a set of Continental tires at your local Discount Tire store or online at discounttire.com. Discount Tire, let's get you taken care of.
Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Toddcast. So, for years, we've reported on two trends, the rising one-party control of state houses across the country and the decline of local news media to report on what those in power are doing. We know that state houses often have been the home of what you would call test legislation that could push federal policy in one direction or the other. Before Roe was overturned, for instance, there was a steady stream of very provocative state laws in red states, like that abortion bounty hunting rule in Texas. But my guest today says that state houses are actually up to something much bigger than that, than just these incremental policy tests or sort of laboratory experiments, if you will, for democracy, that they actually want something bigger, a constitutional convention. So I'm joined now by Russ Feingold. He's a former Democratic senator from Wascan. And before that, he, of course, was a state legislator. He was a Wisconsin state senator representing the area around Madison. He's the co-author of a new book. It's called this, The Constitution in Jeopardy, an unprecedented effort to rewrite our fundamental law and what we can do about it. He wrote the book with constitutional scholar Peter Prindeville. Senator Feingold, welcome to the Toddcast.
Chuck, it's good to be on. Thanks for considering this topic.
So it's interesting, you know, had Hillary Clinton won in 2016, I believe it was Texas that was trying, and it was Greg Abbott, if I recall, that was desperately trying to sort of create a momentum for a, let's have a constitutional convention, a convening. And, you know, it sounds like you wrote this from the perspective of my first reaction to that, which is, oh, gosh, can our politics handle rewriting the Constitution if we chose to do it? This feels like the ultimate political stunt. And then Trump won and it was shelved. But I'm curious what your motivation was to write this and how concerned are you that this is coming?
Well, Peter Prindeville and I have studied this for years. What we would say, I think, is, first of all, it's not a stunt. It's a real thing, and it's permitted by the Constitution. Yes, it's been endorsed by the likes of Scott Walker, and Rick Santorum, and some of the big funders of right-wing things, such as the Koch brothers and Mercers. But the problem is, unlike the January 6th horrible events and some of the others, this one is completely legal. Mm-hmm. And you're right. It is basically driven by the state legislatures who want to do it. They only need two-thirds of the states to apply for a constitutional convention, 34 states. And then our understanding after a deep dive on this for many years is that Congress doesn't have a sort of discretion. Congress has to call a constitutional convention. And then the problem is, there are no rules set out in the Constitution for how the heck this is going to work. So there is a possibility here not only of a right-wing-driven rewriting of the Constitution, but also of a constitutional crisis, because it's not at all clear. In fact, it's unlikely that the Supreme Court would intervene. And we would be in a very serious mess. And we are fearful, frankly, that this could happen as soon as January. If a certain party takes control of the Congress.
Well, so could Congress expedite this? Is that what your concern is, that they could? Because I don't think you're going to get two-thirds of the legislatures, right? I don't, because this feels like right now a partisan exercise. But maybe I'm wrong.
Well, it is partisan, but keep in mind, there's an overwhelming partisan edge to the Republicans and the state legislature.
Yeah, it was just
so. Yeah. What they do is, and we have a whole chapter about this, about the counting problem. What they argue, some of these folks, is that you can take petitions from the past, even from before the Civil War. You can take balanced budget petitions or applications. You can take the so-called convention of the state applications that are a little bit broader and just count them all together. In fact, Representative Arrington of Texas introduced a bill a few weeks ago saying, you know what, there's enough here right now. So, Chuck, all I got to do is convene a Republican-controlled House and say, we believe there are enough applications, we are calling a convention. And how do you stop that? Who's going to stop that?
Now, you're right, we don't know what the rules of something like this would look like, but do we know that they have to come up with a document?
You mean a product for the convention?
Yeah.
No, of course not. They could do nothing. They could completely change the Constitution. They could do one or two things. The point is that it's completely open-ended. And under the current constitutional understanding, there is no way to sort of limit the topic, even though the applications may have said balanced budget amendment or term limits. Once the door is open, and here's what's worse, it's incredibly malapportioned. I like to say it's like the Electoral College on steroids, because the way they want to do it is have each state represented at the convention get one vote. So all they would need is the majority of the states. And you can imagine what an enormous tilt that gives, because it's not based on the population of this country, but it plays into the partisan divide. And that's why Peter and I in the book say, look, the idea of a convention is not inherently wrong, but at a time of such terrible partisan division, it's a very bad idea and will take our country backward.
Is there a progressive argument for it? I mean, about 5 years ago, there were certainly plenty of progressives who thought, okay, you want to do this exercise? We're open to it.
Yeah, in fact, you're right. In fact, I respect some of the progressive professors who have argued for it, such as Sanford Levinson of Texas and Lawrence Lessig of Harvard. There is an argument that having a convention would be an opportunity to accomplish some things that progressives really, really want, such as getting rid of the Electoral College, such as providing an actual right to vote in the Constitution, such as having something to do with the environment or climate. But the problem is, it's sort of like when you're in a poker game and you've already lost all your money and you say, okay, now I think I'll bet the house. The truth is, there is no reason to believe under the current situation in this country, the state of the legislatures that you just described with malapportionment, that there could possibly be a representation under the current rules, under the current Constitution, that would be good for those who want those progressive changes. So no, constitutional conventions are not only permitted, but were the first thing proposed in 1787. The second mechanism, the congressional mechanism, was proposed later, and then they came up with this compromise. But it would be, frankly, very crazy to do a constitutional convention right now from a progressive point.
Look, I agree. From my cynical view of this whole push is that they just simply want an event to rally around, right? That it's simply, and that the event itself is the feature. The product would be the bug, and so they wouldn't bother with the product. I mean, I say that. I mean, look at what we've seen the reaction now with the Dobbs ruling, right? Is that you have a whole bunch of Republicans now afraid of touching constitutional issues. So it feels like the whole push here is to create a fundraising event. I mean, I hate to be that cynical. It just feels like a grift.
I don't consider that cynical, but I do fear it more. Yeah. I believe that there could be a momentum created.
Yeah.
These funders don't just want a show. The Mercers and the Koch brothers and the extreme conservatives, they do want to rewrite.
What specifically do they want to rewrite? Like, do you guys have an idea of, it's like, what is the, is this really about what, right? I assume it's about their own ability to keep more of the money they make. It's usually money.
What they want to do, because we know what they want to do. They held a mock convention in Williamsburg in 2016. They did a really good job of debating it. And here's what they passed. Restricting Congress's lawmaking authority to a tiny fraction of its current extent, restricting federal agencies' rulemaking authority, repealing the income tax, placing term limits on Congress, and a provision, and this is the favorite one, that would allow 30 state legislatures to nullify any federal law or any regulation. So we don't have to guess. We can say, look, there's other things they could do.
By the way,
they could ban abortion.
You just talked about it. It is all financial. It's all financial motivation, what you just described there. I mean, it's just all financial.
I'm not going to doubt that.
Yeah.
But you can bet that there would be social engineering
and
social issues that would come up. But once that door is open, they're going to go for it. And if they want, like you talked about whether or not anything would come out of it, you add in some of those emotional social issues, and all of a sudden, there's a danger of real momentum that could lead to 38 states.
No, I see what you mean. I guess let's talk about, though, the root issue here, which is the undemocratic. The small d undemocratic, I guess you would call it momentum, whatever it is that we have in our state legislative process, right? It just, I grew up in Florida. I always use the state of Florida. The state of Florida is so gerrymandered on how its legislature works that they actually know who their Speaker of the House is going to be like years in advance. I mean, it is. And so what happens? That Speaker gets lobbied years in advance before you actually even become Speaker. I mean, it is literally a legislature run by lobbyists in Tallahassee. And there's no Correct. Uproar over it. Like, it has been really hard. You know, Florida is particularly hard to penetrate to get people to understand sort of the civic problems of local governance. But how do you, this to me is the root problem, right? You have people manipulating a process because they've already manipulated a process.
Well, you probably don't have to tell me that money in politics is
I understand that. And we're going to get there. I don't know if it can be stopped. But anyway.
Yeah, but let me say that. Let me use my state as an example of what you just described. So, no, this isn't something that's organically from Wisconsin. ALEC and these other organizations produce the documents that our malapportioned legislature in Wisconsin will pass on a moment's notice. So, for example, in 2018, we elected a Democratic governor, a Democratic lieutenant governor, a Democratic attorney general, a Democratic state treasurer, and we lost ground in the state legislature, which is almost impossible without extreme gerrymandering. So what are these people all about? Election denial. They're all about this independent state legislature theory where they think they can disregard the results as certified by the Secretary of State and approved by the state Supreme Court. There seems to be a willingness to do just about anything. So if you throw into this their ability to choose these delegates, which is what they've passed legislation to choose the delegates for a convention, and the fact that these people are already being trained at these training sessions like the one in Williamsburg, they're way ahead of those who might think it's a good idea to have a convention because they're getting ready to go. They're training.
I guess I come back to, you know, the Democratic Party has paid lip service to state legislature organizing, but that's all. I mean, there's just not the same level of intense effort. You know, everything seems to be piled onto the federal level, right? That the left seems to believe, well, as long as you get the presidency, and then if they don't have the presidency, as long as you get a chamber of Congress, everything's going to be okay. That there's just very little effort in these purple and even redder states to truly target the state legislatures. And so they can change. I mean, the only way you could stop the partisan gerrymandering is to get in the room.
Yeah, it's very sadly true. You know, 40 years ago, these folks started figuring out, let's put people on the city council and the county board. They called it farm team. And frankly, I was a young state legislator. And I thought, well, you know, why are they doing that? Well, they were right. And I'm now president of the American Constitution Society. And we have strongly urged, because our main focus in the past has been federal judges, it's got to be state judges. It's got to be attorneys general. It's got to be secretaries of state. Mm-hmm. It's got to be malapportionment. So any serious effort to counter the right in this country has to look at both the national and the state level. And this issue that Peter Prindeville and I have written about is more about the state legislatures, because as you've said, Congress, you know, really just has to say, all right, now you can have a convention. And that's driven by more by the state than the national level.
So let's go to money in politics. And what, I mean, because essentially it was money in politics, and it was the concentration of money on a local level on the right that won all these state legislatures over the last 30 years. And, you know, you guys tackled federal money, and we could talk about, you know, I go back to money in politics, and I don't know if you can regulate it. And I say it this way because there's a scene in Jurassic Park that I love to quote. It's Jeff Goldblum. The old man is arguing, they're all female dinosaurs. I'm not going to let them breed. And he says, life finds a way. And what I've learned in my 30 years in Washington is money finds a way. You guys shut the door in one place, and they opened the door and said, fine, we won't raise big money inside the Democratic and Republican parties. We're going to raise money outside. And the money got even bigger, right? And I know that was never your intent with Senator McCain, right? Obviously. The point is there a, in the last 20 years, have you thought of a better way to do this, a better way to regulate money? Is it really, I think disclosure's our only hope, but what say you?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that what we did was being effective. It's not like our bill didn't work. What's happened was it was working. So the United States Supreme Court, in a ridiculous decision, Citizens United, suddenly without any record at all, said, no, actually, we're going to repeal a law from 1906 that allows that doesn't allow corporations to be involved. So it wasn't like some inherent problem with the law or the approach. It's that a Supreme Court was willing to undo a long, hard-fought bipartisan act of the American people through Congress. So that approach is fine. Citizens United has to be overturned in some way to make this happen. That's not happening anytime soon. But in the meantime, what you can do is what you said, is actually, and the court said this, you have to require disclosure. The court said, we believe this, but you have to require disclosure, and the Congress wouldn't do it. There has to be real penalties for the coordination between these special interests and members of Congress. And there's no real penalty. In fact, it's a joke. You know, one senator enters the room for 5 minutes, goes, nice to see you. And he goes out, and then they ask for all the money. So if you put teeth into it, really made it a felony, those are some things you could do right now and that I've advocated for years. But look, it's not easy. But I do think the approach we had was the right approach, and the Supreme Court destroyed it in many ways without formally overturning it.
I'm going to pause there. We'll be right back after a quick break. You're listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press.
Wherever the road may take you, Discount Tire and Continental Tire get you there safely with the perfect combination of style, comfort, and price. Get a set of Continental tires at your local Discount Tire store or online at discounttire.com. Discount Tire, let's get you taken care of.
If you ever needed to be persuaded that bad things can happen anywhere, then take a journey with us.
From compelling mysteries to in-depth investigations, our Dateline episodes are available as podcasts.
Follow Dateline NBC now to get new episodes every Tuesday. To listen ad-free, subscribe to Dateline Premium on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or datelinepremium.com.
Great storytelling with a twist from the true crime original.
You know, it's interesting you say that, knowing if you knew, let's say that the Supreme Court had already overturned used Citizens United to overturn that old law. Would you have been as comfortable of taking the, because there's one argument that always gets pushed back on McCain-Feingold. Well, whatever you could say about the parties raising this big money, at least we knew where it was going. We knew who controlled it. And there was some accountability. That all of a sudden now we went from a little bit of accountability to none.
I think that's dead wrong. And I know I've argued with some of the political scientists who say it. What they don't know is what goes on in those conversations. And I'm right at the moment near one of these fundraising operations, a couple of doors down, where the member comes in with the special interest person and there is a quid pro quo conversation involving direct contact. There's no limitation on really, although there's a legal limitation, but in fact, what happens is that there is a quid pro quo situation. Not to say that doesn't happen here in other ways, but it's much less direct. So I do believe that making sure that members of Congress cannot be involved with raising unlimited amounts of money is very important to avoid corruption. So I do think that's appropriate. And no, I don't think the problem is that the money's been pushed somewhere else. I'm more in your camp, which is the money finds a way, and you have to figure out ways to prevent that. And I think there's far more to be done to prevent it.
Yeah, the NASCAR approach is my favorite idea, meaning like if you'd said, take Blake Masters, okay? We have a real-world example here, J.D. Vance, where if you said, okay, you can give unlimited donations because we're basically there now with these super PACs. Fine, you give unlimited donations to J.D. Vance. But anybody that gives over $100,000, you have to name check them in every paid advertisement. I'm J.D. Vance. I approve this message funded by Peter Thiel, you know, Russ Feingold and Chuck Todd, right? And my feeling is whatever you set the bar at, if you set it, anybody $100,000, well, then you'd have $99,999 checks written a lot, right? You know, a dollar under. Do you see that as potentially effective, or am I just pipe dreaming?
No, I think that's very helpful. In fact, though, when John McCain and I proposed our bill, the First Amendment was offered by Ron Wyden, and we weren't sure what he was going to do, but it became that famous phrase. Right. I'm Ron Wyden, and I approve this message. I think it is effective. And in California, when I was teaching at Stanford, I helped pass a statewide referendum that required some of the companies mm-hmm. who were doing those referendums in these kind of fake names to actually identify who they are. I do think that helps. It's not enough, but I do think that kind of disclosure is worthwhile.
So to go back to sort of the core point of your book, so we, you're worried about a constitutional convention, but we're also, I think this country is overdue for an overhaul of our rules of democracy, right? Like, constitutional convention is a terrible potential way to manage this. I understand your concern there. But what is, we've got to, look, we've got, let's start with a problem that both Wisconsin and Florida have. The idea that judges are on the ballot. I just find this absolutely asinine. You know, you cannot tell me that a judge who you're expecting to, at least in a courtroom, be impartial, how they can be impartial when their livelihood is on the line on a ballot funded by somebody else, even if they don't know it. What's the best way to reform our democracy right now if you don't believe a constitutional convention is healthy?
Well, you just said it perfectly. And what Peter Prindeville and I have said is the Constitution's in jeopardy in two ways. The first jeopardy is the one we've been talking about, the possibility of a gerrymandered right-wing constitutional convention. The other is not changing it at all. The Constitution is stagnated. It's ossified. You can't really amend it. It's the hardest one in the world to amend. So we propose, and this is a very important part of our book, dealing with that second jeopardy by having a constitutional amendment pushed through Congress. Hopefully that could be done on a bipartisan basis at some point to change Article 5 of the Constitution, which is the provision that makes the rules. You have to make it so that there is a popular element to approving a constitutional amendment. So one idea is to have every state has a majority of the states have to approve it by popular vote, and a nationwide referendum would have to approve it by popular vote. We also would say that Congress should be able to make some rules for these conventions. In other words, some kind of topic limitation rules. How should the delegates be chosen? Because right now it's just an okay corral that could lead to a constitutional crisis. So we specifically lay out the ways in which this could be changed so you could have what you described, people of all different political views coming together and saying, all right, let's have a constitutional convention. Look, they just did it in Chile. It didn't pass, but they elected a completely independent set of delegates mm-hmm. who worked hard on proposing a new constitution. It didn't pass, but it was a very constructive thing for the country because it was based on a popular will. We the people. The Constitution begins with we the people. Mm-hmm. It does not begin with we the states.
Right.
So somehow the reform of Article 5 has to be about the people as a majority, not simply a very strong minority that's working hard to rewrite the Constitution and send us back to the Articles of Confederation.
Are you working with any constitutional conservatives on that idea?
Well, we have talked to them. In mm-hmm. fact, some of the people that have endorsed our book mm-hmm. are people that respect our view. They don't necessarily agree with everything we say, but Sai Prakash at the University of Virginia mm-hmm. thinks this is an important book. Michael McConnell, a very famous mm-hmm. Conservative constitutional scholar at Stanford. My good friend, who I wouldn't say is a conservative or a liberal, but Richard Fallon at Harvard Law School. They have all looked at this and said, this is something worth thinking about. And actually, McConnell held sort of a mock constitutional convention out at Stanford a few years ago, and I was there. And I proposed some amendments, right. and some of the other people opposed it. The idea of a convention is not in itself inherent. It is not illegal. It is not wrong. But in this environment, it could be disastrous. And that's why it should be opposed in the current.
So what you're saying is you could be open to a constitutional convention, but not the way that the right is, that there's forces on the right are trying to force it. So if you change Article 5, so in theory, if you got to write the bill and see it passed, it would force every state to have state referendum on this or have a delegate or just create a process in general.
Yeah, I mean, there are different ways it can be done. But, you know, in order for something to actually be approved, it would have to get a majority, not just something engineered by the state legislature.
A majority of actual people, not people. Yeah.
Yeah. One, I mean, it could pass the legislature first and then the public might have a vote on it. Mm-hmm. after, like, you know, like the way we pass constitutional amendments in most states, like Wisconsin, which is you pass a constitutional amendment in two legislative sessions, but then it has to go to Congress.
Now, what if the pushback is, well, we're not a democracy, or we're a republic?
Well, there's nothing about a republic that can't have this kind of a rule. Mm-hmm. What I just described was not a pure majority vote process. It's a process that involves the states and a certain number of states, but also a popular vote. It doesn't repeal the Congress, which is a representative form of government. But in the end, yes, there is a moment under our system of government where we, the people, the majority of the people, should be able to weigh in and change their constitution. And George Washington himself said, as they were finally completing the Constitution, he said, you know, we don't really imagine that we have the wisdom that is greater than future generations. Mm-hmm. We would expect that they would want to change this and that it should be changed by the people. And that's why we think a new Article 5 is overdue. They didn't get it quite right then. They didn't. It's right. A wonderful document, but they sort of misfired on it.
Well, but in fairness on Article 5, you know, it was a very skeptical, you know, these were people that were extraordinarily skeptical of centralized government. Right, because it was once in their minds one step away from a monarchy.
Yeah, in fact, the two mechanisms reflect two different views. Right. The Hamilton view was, yeah, let's just have Congress do the amendments, and we'll, you know, we'll repair things, and the national government knows better. But the Mason view was the opposite, which is we the people should be able to do it through a constitutional convention. Problem is, they gave us no rules to figure out how to do.
Well, this. Imagine this, but it's like if they knew that it was, in theory, fairly easy for everybody to vote, potentially, you know, would they have given so much power to the legislatures, right? Like, you know, there was a reason why we had to be a representative democracy, because, you know, not everybody could participate in civil affairs.
I don't know what they would have thought.
Right. You know, we don't know for sure if technology were what it is today, back then, if there would have been a different mindset. So let me ask you this. Let's talk about certain things that you think have to be handled in the Constitution versus congressional law. Regulating money, judicial term limits, how we decide whether we should, you know, how reapportionment works. Are these things that you think should be written into the Constitution, or are these things that you think the federal legislature should be able to handle?
Well, I would say not necessarily, and the first instinct should not be a constitutional amendment. But when it becomes clear that something is so problematic that it has to be changed through a constitutional amendment, then it's needed. For example, the Electoral College. There is an approach out there that I've supported to try to do it through a compact. I think that would be difficult to get through the courts, but it'd be better just to eliminate it. That requires constitutional convention. You were right that American Constitution Society has come to the view that there ought to be term limits for the Supreme Court justices. Some people think you can do that legislatively. Probably not.
Yeah, separation
it
of powers,
probably
right?
Probably requires constitutional amendment. Yeah. So, and I happen to be of the view, speaking only for myself here, that there should be a right to vote enshrined in the Constitution. It's not in the Constitution. Something that would actually say you have a right to vote as a hook in order to try to strike down some of the things that are going on, and that your vote should count the same as everyone else's. But you know, none of this is likely to happen without some kind of reform of Article 5 through a constitutional amendment.
Yeah.
So
is your efforts, do you think, primarily have to be concentrated on a state-by-state basis? Or do you think lobbying Congress is the better is the better alternative here?
I mean, it's going to be important that members of Congress are aware that there are people in Congress that are trying to make this case that they can already call a convention. Mm-hmm. So that's something members of Congress in both houses have to be concerned about if they've got some real momentum on it, and that is serious. But the battle is probably at least as much, perhaps more, at the state legislative level, because that's where the driving force is. But this is a nationally funded, very far right, big money operation where all of this is coordinated, as you indicated. This isn't somebody out in Arizona thinks we ought to do this or somebody should do that. This is all cooked up together, and we are taking the lid off. We are saying this is what's happening. People need to know about it. People need to talk about it. And if they think that it's a bad idea to have this constitutional convention now, they have to act at both the state and federal level to oppose it.
I want to close. I want to get you out of here on a slightly different topic. In a couple weeks, I'm traveling to Wisconsin to do a piece that's not just on the current battleground, but how Wisconsin has foreshadowed our polarization, right? Where the nation is today, Wisconsin was yesterday, you know, and where the nation was yesterday, Wisconsin was, you know, before. It's spooky how Wisconsin has played this role for us over a century, whether it's the progressive movement, McCarthyism, or polarization. Wisconsin's no better today than it was 10 years ago or 15 years ago when this polarization really came to the forefront. And yet people have attempted to sort of fix the quote unquote fix the problem. What can we learn? What are the wrong lessons to take away from the attempts at, because it feels like Wisconsin's as polarized as ever. And there are really good, there had been people and well-meaning people on both sides of the aisle trying to turn the temperature down, but it hasn't been possible. What's your take?
Well, you're right. That certainly for a good part of my lifetime, Wisconsin had a very different, very positive reputation. Now, we got to remember, we've had some very rough times in the past. Mm-hmm. We're the state of Joe McCarthy. Mm-hmm. You know, this was in the
50s. For good and bad, Wisconsin sometimes leads the way.
But in the 60s and 70s, one of the reasons as a young guy I wanted to enter politics, it was great. Right. There was a wonderful demeanor. Bipartisanship was valued. Environmental issues were common between both sides. There was a tremendous amount of civility when I was in the state Senate for 10 years. And this started to fall apart when our traditional fault line in the state, we were not like some other states where there's a big moderate middle. Mm-hmm. There's a tendency in our state to have kind of a hard right and a hard left.
Yeah.
And that's why one side wins sometimes, the other side does, but it leads to this polarization. And we have it right now. We have a progressive governor and attorney general, and we have an extreme right-wing legislature. And they seem to not reflect the same constituents, even though the same people were voting. And this is a very difficult thing to resolve because they tend to punish, particularly in the conservative side, they punish anybody who starts working on the other side.
Yeah.
And that is very, very bad for democracy in Wisconsin and in the country.
Is it? Because Wisconsin also feels extremely geographically polarized.
That's correct. Yeah. I always compare it to Minnesota, where you sort of have the Twin Cities are kind of the hub and things generate from out there. We have really strong geographic differences. I mean, up in the very far north, it's liberal. The Fox River Valley is very conservative. The area around Milwaukee is incredibly conservative, and yet Madison and Milwaukee are pretty liberal. It isn't sort of consistent.
It used to be Brown County was the one place that you could go. Green Bay was the most 50-50 county, Brown County, and even that has shifted, right? It's still
I benefited. I knew I could win a race if I was going to do okay in Brown County, but these days it's extremely hard for Democrats.
It's interesting.
Even if the Packers had won.
Right. It's interesting what you say here, because this is a theory I've had, which is there's – you get punished for trying to work in the middle, right? Whether you're, you know, because there's so much distrust that any attempt to, quote, give the other side a victory is just too great of a pull, isn't it?
That's right. And I saw that sort of grow up in 2009, 2010. I remember being at a town meeting when people were really trying to shut down our town meetings. And somebody mentioned climate change. And I said, well, I think it's a serious problem. They started booing. And I said, well, Lindsey Graham's working with John Kerry on this issue. And they started saying, he's a rhino. Yeah. He's a Republican in name only. And I went, okay.
Yeah, right. You're like, oh, gosh.
Lindsey Graham's a turncoat, you know. So, and I saw that was an example of very un-Wisconsin-like conduct based on the history that I'd been growing up to believe in.
Well, it does feel as if, until I sort of am. The only optimistic thing you said is that post-McCarthy, Wisconsin sort of saw a different. And I wonder if we get past this moment we're in with Trumpism, is there this sort of sense of relief and people go, oh, let's avoid that situation, right? I mean, I guess that's about the only optimism I took away.
I would hope so, because I think people get tired of the anger. Mm-hmm. I think people get tired of the suspicion of neighbors. And, you know, Wisconsin's this beautiful, wonderful
place. And everybody's a Packer fan. Like, there is one thing everybody agrees on.
We love getting around the state. Yeah. We like, you know, it's not, you know, like Obama said, it's not red and blue places. You know, you might be in your blue home and you go up to this wonderful lake in northern Wisconsin. We should all enjoy it together and treat each other well. And I feel bad about it.
Yeah. Russ Feingold, you're always pushing the envelope, very thoughtful, and force greater intellectual exercise than maybe some of your former colleagues do. So it's good to talk to you.
Thanks, Chuck.
You've been listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Elias Miller, Justice Gilpin Green, and Matt Rivera. Our theme music composed by Spoke Media. Meet the Press Now is live every day at 4 p.m. Eastern on NBC News Now, and you can watch it anywhere and at any time on YouTube, meetthepress.com, or just Google NBC News Now, and it will pop up for you. And of course, the big show is available every Sunday, wherever you get your NBC station. Thanks for listening, and until we upload again.
Wherever the road may take you, Discount Tire and Continental Tire get you there safely with the perfect combination of style, comfort, and price. Get a set of Continental tires at your local Discount Tire store or online at discounttire.com. Discount Tire, let's get you taken care of.